Oliver Zonkey. Born on this day, we celebrate him at this moment with his music, Zonkey. Great piece from back in the day, early jazz sound from this country. We are about to enter the conversation we talked about at the very top of the hour. I remind you, on the way there, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and students, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org, or just log on to SteinerShow.org and click on their banner. It is right there on our website. So we are about to enter this conversation because of what happened the other day when this 22-year-old man, Elliot Roger, mowed down numbers of people in his home city in California by luring several men into his apartment, stabbing them to death, and then going on a rampage targeting women. A lot has been written about that since. So we are going to attack that question, look at that question this hour, from a number of angles. There's all these questions of mental health and mental illness and access to it that have been raised. Now, there's arguing that that would never have found them because all these men who commit these raging crimes that are actually a minority of murderers in America, but that they are not people who access the mental health system to start with. We'll look at that. But there are deeper issues here around misogyny and race in America. And this, as a tip, the kind of vast, violent tip of a deeper iceberg in America. Of our attitude towards women, about men's thinking about women, about misogyny, about the things he wrote about where he thought of himself as not white enough. He couldn't get the blonde figure of woman that he wanted, which is the epitome of womanhood for much of America in our kind of conscious and unconscious thinking. So we're going to tackle all that with our guests here. We're here with Dr. Kate Drabinsky once again, lecturer in gender and men's studies and director of the Women Involved in Learning and Leadership program at UMBC. Good to have you here, Kate, once again.
Nice to see you.
Adora Ayera is back in the studio. She's coming here so much we have to start paying her, I think. Project manager, if we had any money. Project manager of the More in the Middle campaign for Associated Black Charities, facilitator and analyst for the Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a program of fusion partnerships and a spoken word artist. Good to have you back, Adora.
Thank you for inviting me back.
Always good to have you here. Dr. John Bullock is also back in the studio again, professor of political science at Towson University. Good to have you back.
Good to be here.
And we are joined by phone by Igor Volsky, who is managing editor of Think Progress.org and author of the article that appeared on the alternate site called Behind the Sexist Ideology That Preoccupied Mass Murderer Elliot Roger. And Igor, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
And you all can join us here, 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888 is the number here. So there's so many places you can start this conversation, but when you – there are two things. Let me just start this way. When you look at the writings of this young man who committed these heinous crimes, you can clearly see he was mentally ill. You also can see he's very bright. He's both bright and mentally ill. And on the other hand – I think that to leave it there is a problem because it also kind of poses, I mean, it also kind of is just, as I said earlier, the tip of the iceberg of a much deeper issue that faces America that is represented in this horrendous killing that took place. Just let me open with those initial thoughts. Adora, you had this askance look on your face when I said that. Why?
Well, the propensity to call or frame as a mental illness anything that happens, any heinous crime that happens, when it happens by someone with all white or partially white ancestry, is of concern. It is further marginalizing a community, a group of people who are marginalized, number one, and who the majority of them never do anything like that. So I have issues with that unless we are willing to say that racialization is in itself a mental illness.
It might be. I guess I put it that way because the majority of murders that take place are not taking place by people we would classify as mentally ill. The majority of people who are mentally ill do not commit murders. But I think that there has to be some serious mental dysfunction when you very consciously mow down 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 people in these events that take place, even though they're a minority of any of the murders that take place in America. I mean, that's what I mean by that.
Yeah, and I understand that point. But if this person were African-American, he would just be labeled a straight-up thug. So I question the framing of it and the way that we frame things, these horrible types of crimes, depending on who has committed them.
You know, I think there's also something else to this, and I do understand the point about how we frame it. But I will say, in terms of privilege, you could argue that his privilege is what also insulated him from the mental illness that he has, right? So we know that people who tend to be of the majority of, right, upper middle class, white, or wealthy and white, tend to be categorized as eccentric or different or odd, as opposed to someone who has a mental illness. And so he might not have sought the help, or his family might not have sought the help that he truly needed. And again, you could see even from the way that he even proposes this, right? I mean, through his writings, through web postings, when he's in his BMW, as he does this video and does all these posts. So clearly there's an element of privilege that also comes out even in his rantings and ravings about what he winds up doing.
So, Igor, let me go ahead. I do want to get to Igor and another guest here.
Yeah, I was just going to say this, Mark. In this whole conversation of whether he was or was not mentally ill, I don't want to get lost the way in which he racialized his agenda. He wasn't going after women. He was going after white women. He had a problem with his being half Asian, half white, seeing people who were not, as he described them in his writings, fully white, getting, as he described in his writings, white women or blonde, hot white women, that was his issue. So as we move forward in this conversation, please let's talk about, using his writings, what his issues were. And it was a lot narrower and a lot more racialized than just mental illness or running after women or being angry at women or targeting women.
And maybe, I guess what I've been arguing back, and let's go to Igor and then go to Kate. I mean, it was both, from my perspective.
Yeah, it does seem to be both. And in his particular case, he did have some kind of mental condition, had been under the care of psychiatrists for quite some time, rejected treatment at age 18. He was prescribed drugs that he stopped taking. And it was from age 18 to 22 when he spent all that time planning this incredible attack. But I think you also look at the community that he was part of, and this is kind of what my piece tried to get at, is there is this community called the anti-PUA community. These are a group of people who are trying to expose pickup artists or the seduction industry, all of these books like The Game that purport to teach men what to do to attract women, to attract beautiful women and to enter relationships and have sexual relationships with women. And these men in the anti-PUA community all felt like they tried those methods and they failed. And so through a series of websites and message boards, they would vent their anger not only at these at the seduction community, but also, as some of the other folks have said, at women more generally, about why white women are with black men and why women aren't attracted to them. They would post pictures of themselves and try to critique each other about how best to do their hair so that women would be attracted to them. Are their chin lines just right as women like them? Do they need plastic surgery to look better? And he really comes out of that subculture, if you will, that believes that women were put on this earth to have sex with men and that men are entitled to women's bodies.
I mean, I guess one issue I have with the framing of it in terms of mental illness is it exceptionalizes this instance, and it certainly is exceptional that this man would mow down so many people, but it's also the logical conclusion of a culture that encourages people to sexualize and objectify white women in a certain kind of way as opposed to women of color who are objectified in an entirely different way. And it also acts as if this violence is not a daily occurrence. So it's one way that I get frustrated at this moment, because mental health issues, you know, as someone who's open about her own mental illness, it doesn't really help me or the community of people that I know who deal with mental illness to sort of have this become an issue about that kind of care. And it also doesn't help me as a teacher of feminism and somebody who works with young women who are facing the daily like gauntlet of men's sexism and harassment to sort of act like this is – it's sort of the end case, but it is the logical result, I would argue, of a culture that's encouraging this kind of sexualization of women.
So let me make a connection here, and it's because I do not want to get hung up on the question of mental illness or not.
I also don't want to get hung up on all of us diagnosing this guy who we don't know.
Right, exactly. But let me try to make a connection. I mean, that's to say that one can be mentally ill or not, as this young man may have been.
Right, and one has a mental illness. One isn't simply mentally ill.
Exactly. On the other hand, what you just said, Kate, is the connection between this particular mass act of mowing down numbers of people, killing three women, going after women at a women's center, women were the athletic center. Clearly what his target was, and these men he killed earlier were clearly his target, people think, because they were men he saw as men who got the women he thought he should get. But two things. A, there's a larger perception, in America, in culture, period, that we men, heterosexual men, no matter who we are, deserve women and deserve whatever women we want. And that's part of the game we've been played in our head since we were little boys.
Not only do you deserve them, but if you don't get them, you're not really a man.
And if you don't get them, you're not really a man. Exactly true. Right. Exactly right. And B, that even though he mowed down all these people, what you also just said, Kate, is that daily violence takes place against women and the rape that takes place daily in our society, in every corner of our society, that this is a kind of larger public manifestation of violence that permeates who we are as a people. Mm-hmm. As human beings.
I think that that's true. I mean, you look at every aspect of our culture and you can see that. And in a conversation that I had the other day when we were talking about issues like this, one person said to me, you know, again, is this America as a society reaping what it sows in terms of the roles that we give to men and women, the ways in which we punish men and women who act outside of those assigned societal roles, the ways in which we reward them when they stay in those roles, the ways in which popular culture perpetuates those roles. Are we just reaping what we've sown?
You know, I would argue to some degree we are. I think, though, there's some kind of step between culture and then what happens here, right? So I totally get, you know, we do have a misogynist culture, we do have a white supremacist culture, we do have a culture that includes a lot of violence. At the same time, I really believe it's this privilege that then activates this sort of understanding of the culture for what it is, right? Because there are millions of people every day who live in this culture who don't take that next step or that final step in terms of enacting violence. And so we know there's violence that happens against women on a daily basis. We know that we're talking about relationship violence. We're talking about unwanted advances. We know all those things that happen. But when someone is of, even though his background is racially mixed, again, in terms of white supremacist, upper class, has resources to then enact or then act upon those feelings or that feeling of now I've been betrayed because now it's unfair toward me. Because that was what I kept getting from his diatribe, was that this is unfair. I was owed this, right? And so now when you feel you don't get what you're owed, now you have to act in such a disproportionate way. Mm-hmm.
Well, what's tremendous, if I may, what's tremendous, I think, in the aftermath of all this is the outpouring of response that we've seen online, on Twitter, of women really coming forward and talking about how they struggle with this on a daily basis of unwanted advances from men, and that this happens to them all the time, telling their personal stories in 140 characters. Just a tremendous outpouring. It's a conversation, I think, that came out of this tragedy. And on the other end, you have these guys in the seduction industry who have used this killing to drum up more business to say that the reason why this happened is because this guy didn't have any quote-unquote game. And so, you know, it's a conversation we'll continue to have. And I think we now see elements of it not just online and in the culture, but also in our politics, when Democrats are now running in the midterms on wage equality, on boosting the minimum wage, which would disproportionately help women, on ensuring that people have health care, which, again, would disproportionately help women, and then running under this moniker of broader war on women. It's kind of amazing that this conversation is happening in all aspects of society.
Yeah, and one thing that I think is really important in this moment is to also interrogate masculinity, because this is about misogyny, but it's also about the construction of masculinity. I mean, men are by far and away the greatest perpetrators of physical violence, but they're also its greatest victims, and we don't talk about that a lot. But violence is, like, what is it about the construction of masculinity that would make him feel like he wasn't a real man? You know, and you see it in the media representation of him as, quote, the, quote, kissless virgin. And I know those are his words, but who would, you know, I went to college and had been kissed, and I didn't think of myself as some sad kissless virgin. I thought of myself as, you know, a freshman in college. So what is it about that construction of masculinity that how do we undo that at the same time?
Because I think, let me just throw this out here. I think what happens is that men, from their childhood, are made to feel that you are not worth it unless, A, you're a good athlete, can hit a ball, catch a ball, that you can make up all these lies about who you've had sex with when you haven't had sex with anybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a big part of being a young man. That mm-hmm. happens all the time. That women are seen as the sexual object that you want to conquer, so you can say you've had sex and then keep dominating. I mean, that is the culture that I think, and I think that what the battle is now in conversations like this, I think, when these things happen, these horrendous things happen, and we should be doing this when the things that don't hit the headlines all the time happen, with the rapes and the violence and the rest, is that maybe it's a time because the women's movement that erupted into this country, out of the civil rights movement, out of the movements of the 60s, have forced a different kind of society, so people have to rethink what we are. That's the conversation. We need to rethink who we are, I think, mm-hmm. as human beings. That's the place we are in now.
Yeah, and rethink our relationships to each other. You know, and one thing that I fear that this kind of event does is it acts like, okay, I need to be careful when I'm at the women's club or something. That's when I'm like, but women are still the least safe in their own homes, you know, and it's not bad, scary, crazy people who hurt women. It's our brothers and our fathers and our friends and our uncles, and it's people who are, quote, nice guys. You know, it's not just that crazy guy in the car.
So I'm going to take a quick break and come back. Adar, you can pick right up on that thought. And I want to read some of the things he wrote about where his confusion about race and sex and who he was are all over his writings, what that says about a larger sense. Because I think he represents something deeper in our society. It's not just him alone. We're going out here with Walkin' and Swingin'. The great Mary Lou Williams, one of the great jazz composers and pianists and writers, passed away on this day in 1981. And this is Andy Kirk in his 12 Clouds of Joy, remembering the great Mary Lou Williams. Floyd, The Dark Side of the Moon, on this day became number one in both U.S. and Great Britain for 741 continuous weeks from 1973 to 1988. It's a long time to be on the top of the heart, so we give them a little play out there. Go back to our guests here with Dr. Kate Trubinsky, a lecturer in gender and women's studies and director of the Women Involved in Learning and Leadership program at Morgan State, at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, pardon me, Dr. John Bullock, professor of political science at Towson University, Igor Volsky, who is managing director of thinkprogress.org, author of the article that appeared in Alternate called Behind the Sexist Ideology That Preoccupied Mass Murderer, Elliot Roger, and Adara Ayira, project manager of the More in the Middle campaign for Associate Black Charities and facilitator and analyst at the Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a program of Fusion Partnerships, 410-319-8888. Join us with your thoughts about this huge topic. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com, 410-319-8888. We want to hear your ideas on just where we think our society is in terms of race and sex, sexism and misogyny, and how this leads to what happened with this young man in California and the horrendous crime he committed. And Adara, you were going to say before we went to break.
You know, it seems from his writing that there was such a struggle, an internal struggle, that he was warring against his privilege as part of a white family, as a moneyed, economically secure person, and then his internalized oppression, his self-hatred, because he was also part Asian.
Wasn't white enough.
And, right, he was not white enough, according to his own writings. And it is so easy to slap a label of mental illness, and he may be. One of your guests says that he was, and I'm sure, you know. But if that is just what we talk about, then we miss the larger cultural conversation that we must have in order to address these issues and in order to make sure that this does not happen again.
I mean, when we live in this world that we talked about, I think earlier Igor was talking about the pickup artists and this whole culture that's taking place right now, and what it really says about what's especially with younger people, what's happening with this whole idea of what has to be done so you can get a lady, mm-hmm. so you can have her to have sex with you.
Yeah, and you don't have to delve into the world of like pickup artists and their secret online community. I mean, you can just listen to men who are walking around talking, right? Or you can be sexually harassed by. I'm just thinking about the way that in my experience sexual harassment has worked, right? Like, for example, I remember one time riding my bike down the street and having a guy like yell out something about that's inappropriate for radio, and and watching him and his friend sort of giggle about it and having this moment of understanding in a really visceral way that this had nothing to do with me or my body. This was about two men proving their masculinity to each other, right? And I don't have to go into, you know, onto some pickup artist website to see that in my daily life. You know, in the stories I hear from my students, this is just sort of happening. But I think it's really important to get back to that cultural conversation. You know, so what is it about the production of Asian masculinity as being sort of less than masculine, right? Mm-hmm. Where black men are often portrayed as hyper-masculine, white men as having over-sexualized, white men as having a really reasonable sexuality that needs to be fed regularly
and satisfied,
should be and satisfied. Mm-hmm. It's extremely important for white men. And Asian men as not really being sexual objects or sexual subjects. And that kind of construction, I think we need to talk about that rather than focus on how to diagnose this one man's mental illness or not, because that's the culture that we're all living in. And I think your point, Mark, about trying to figure out how to have relationships with each other as the world changes is something we just don't talk about enough.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned, you know, the society we live in, and it's very interesting, you know, that there's so many things going on here, right? So, I mean, if you think about it just from the male-female perspective, right? So you have, you know, on one side, either you're a ladies' man or you're the kissless, you know, virgin who has no game, right? But if you're a woman, either you're a slut or you're a prude, and there's no middle ground in between.
And both are terrible.
And both are terrible, right? So, yeah, so there's a shaming on either side of all of this. And all of that tends to be created by men. At the same time, also very deep into this is that self-hate, and that is also driving the illness that he's suffering from. I mean, it's exacerbating it. I mean, he's at tension with himself, right? I mean, I thought it was very interesting. I mean, just looking at some of the writings where you can't believe that there's another Asian guy who actually now gets to talk to a white woman, right? And so you mentioned, you know, the asexualization of Asian men, particularly in popular culture. You look at the movies, the guy, he never gets the girl. Even if he gets the girl, he never kisses the girl. So I think he's internalized some of that. But again, that battle within himself, and that's really a product of white supremacy that a lot of people haven't seen. I mean, we've had conversations within the black community about this, you know, for years in terms of proximity to whiteness, how one takes that inside, but then also how they project it onto their kids and other people around them. So I think all of that's happening here.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you do say, I mean, let me just come right to Adar, get back to Igor, who we haven't heard from in a few minutes. But like he wrote in his manifesto, how disgruntled he was by this black man coming in, talking about how he lost his virginity with a young white blonde girl, and seeing him with a blonde girl, or seeing this dark Mexican guy sitting with a blonde girl. You know, this was really, he was like obsessed with this. But that obsession also, I think, also we have to talk about it in terms of its deeper consequence in our society that doesn't always play itself out with somebody who's going to mow down seven people, but or whatever that was, nine people, but that, you know, that it's something much deeper in the culture we live in we have to wrestle with.
Absolutely. I mean, continuing the idealization of white women, and particularly blonde white women, and any white woman who's thought of to be quote-unquote hot as being the prize, that, again, those are the women that he was writing about. Those are the women that he was targeting. And we cannot forget that in our analysis of this event.
Igor, we haven't heard from you a minute. Why don't you jump in before we go back to Kay? I'm sorry.
Well, I think if you quickly think of how he thought things should go when he got to college, that he was supposed to kind of just find a woman, charm her, that she would sleep with him, or maybe not even one woman, but many, that resembles the plots of many romantic comedies that are out now, that are coming out, this idea that a geeky kid who, you know, kind of had no game, so to speak, to use that lexicon, gets to college and is taken under the arm of some guy or a group of guys who teaches him how to get the girl, and then in one way or another he gets the girl and it's true love. I mean, those ideas he had to exert from somewhere, and I don't think you have to go far to find some of the genesis.
Well, let me tell you two things here. One of the things I found interesting, Anne Hornaday, who's at Washington Post,
right, I saw that.
movie critic, and has been a guest on the show for the last 20 years, wrote a really interesting piece. She wrote this, she called this the toxic double helix of insecurity and entitlement that you see in Hollywood films. She wrote, "For generations, mass entertainment has been overwhelmingly controlled by white men whose escapist fantasies who often revolve around vigilantism and sexual wish fulfillment, often, if not always, featuring a steady through line of casual misogyny. Roger's rampage may be a function of his own profound distress, but it also shows how a sexist movie monoculture can be toxic for men, women and men alike." And she wrote this because he comes out of a family within the movie culture. But so, I mean,
yeah. And if you look at how few, you know, the kind of media monopolies we have, and how few white men are actually in charge, right? If you look at who are the CEOs of all the media conglomerates, you're looking at a bunch of white men, and they're producing not just culture that is, you know, cultural products like Superbad, which I had the misfortune of watching just 2 days before this event happened. I hadn't seen it before. I was like, wow, that's some through line of misogyny. But anyway, it's also funny, right? We got to think about why we find that funny, but that's for another show. But they control all aspects, right? So a lot of times in my classes, students will talk about, you know, misogyny and hip hop music. And the hip hop music that they're seeing is largely controlled by white men who are the producers of, you know, who are the people who are engaging in this business of making that music, and their fantasies about black masculinity, right? And their fantasies about white masculinity are also running through all of these cultural products. So it's, you know, one thing that we talk about in my classes anyway is the importance of creating our own culture and our own media, because these are not the images that people necessarily want. It's just that's all we have access to.
You know, Mark, there were three more victims that get such short shrift here, too, and that was Chin Wan Hong, George Chin, and Wei Han Wang. So he stabbed them repeatedly. Was that a part of him killing himself? Was it a part of his self-hatred? And again, I think that the way that the media is framing this, you know, kissless virgin and women is another indication of how we marginalize and dismiss the importance of the lives of people of color, that you very rarely hear about these three young Asian men who he stabbed to death.
That's a really good point.
Right.
That's a good point.
Yeah, most certainly. I mean, and that's where, you know, it's unfortunate that really gets swept under the rug. But there is this stream of violence. One thing that I think keeps getting missed, too, and it does relate even to maleness and whiteness. If you look at gun laws, right, if you look at many of our legislators and you think about many of those who are supporters of NRA and the demographic they speak to are largely white men. Right. And so the idea is that, well, you know, they're going to be responsible gun owners, and there's no need to have limits on the type of mechanisms that these guns have in terms of being automatic and the like. And so you have all of that happening. But what's also weird to me is that these types of movies have been existing forever. So something's happening now where people are reacting differently. Just thinking about, you know, you mentioned, I think the critic mentioned Neighbors, and you just mentioned Superbad. And I'm thinking about these stories where you had someone who's unpopular and trying to get the girl. And maybe you think back to like 30 some odd years ago with like Revenge of the Nerds. Same thing, very misogynist movie. I saw it as a kid, right? But you're seeing all these things happening. But then after that movie's out, no one goes and shoots anybody. No one goes and strangles anybody. No one goes and does all these things, right? So, I mean, there is the ratcheting up of misogyny, but also the ratcheting up of violence, and then it becomes acceptable and normalized, and there's something happening now that's so different than in the past, even though these images have existed for quite some time.
Yeah, one thing I think you're absolutely right about the change in models of masculinity that we see. So Jackson Katz, who's a theorist of masculinity, did a great study where he traced the difference in body size, where you go from somebody like, our movie stars from the 40s mm-hmm. and 50s, and then you go to like Sylvester Stallone, mm-hmm. right? And you go to like where the body itself becomes a weapon, right? And you go mm-hmm. from a small shotgun to the mm-hmm. the kind of, Terminator, my whole body is a giant gun and I'm shooting, right? And so you do see that, and he argues that it's a kind of backlash to gains that feminists have had, you know, and I do think that construction of the male body is itself a weapon is a really interesting
argument. And I would say that even more than that, it is a recentering. It is a recentering of maleness and whiteness mm-hmm. in the world.
Yeah, and one thing I'd like to make sure we don't do in this moment is recenter whiteness as these white women who were victims, when it's really hard in this culture to see women of color as victims at all because mm-hmm. of the role of hypersexualization of their bodies. Right. So we don't want to lose that.
You're saying these women were not victims?
Oh, no, they were absolutely victims. Okay. I just don't want to recenter whiteness or produce this idea that white women are the
But I'm also going to throw out here, though, that Igor, please come into this conversation. You're on the phone there. I mean, that misogyny goes beyond racism and through racism and throughout every culture we have on this planet, including our own.
Mm-hmm. And you make the point about movies about misogyny being around for years and this kind of violence not resulting, you can't help but think that maybe there's something happening here in the economy. The fact that we've had wages for the overwhelming majority of Americans stagnant since about the 1970s, the fact that the riches and economic growth has gone to the very, very few outside of a small period in the 1990s, and you begin to think, well, what role does that play? The fact there's a shrinking middle class, the fact that so many men and women, particularly people of color, have a hard time finding a job that will then advance them into the middle class and ensure economic security of some kind. How does that interact with the culture and the cultural imagery? And what role, if any, does it have in producing the kind of violence we see here, but also really the kind of mass shootings that have become almost normalized in the last several years?
I mean, and maybe you dovetail that with we talk about what the films have done and what entertainment might play into this, is the fact that we are a digitized world, so that when sexism fueled in a young boy's head in the 1950s by Playboy magazine or whatever conversations he was having, is not just something that you find occasionally or have to look for, but it's now in your face 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can't get away from it. Young people are in it all the time. It's no longer this tabloid that sits in the supermarket that your mother said, don't pick that up, leave it alone. It's now something that you go on the web and you watch it anytime you want. And fuels, I think, a world. It fuels warped is the only one coming to mind, mm-hmm. a warped impulse, mm-hmm. and deepens it because it's all around you. You cannot leave it.
We're exposed to an average of 20,000 advertisements a day, right? We don't notice them because it's just our background now. And I think one other issue is just the sort of ubiquitousness of those conversations. I think you're really right.
This society has always been violent, and I do believe that changes in technology and the there is no off button anymore is very important in further inculcating us in this culture. But the reality is that there has always been violence. What has changed is that those people for whom violence is now normalized, those people for whom being a victim is beginning to be now normalized. People of color have always had violence against them in this society. That violence has been state and federally sanctioned for the bulk of this country's history. Now we are seeing more people who were thought to be immune becoming more and more statistically victims of violence. We see changes in the home. We see no off button. We see pushback against what masculinity is supposed to be. And we also see people who have not been entitled because they've been people of color. Now they are becoming more entitled by virtue of their economic status, by virtue of interracial marriages, by virtue of the way society is changing. However, they are still, as this young man said, not fully white.
He said he was not fully white.
He was not fully white. And so, again, there is this very stark dichotomy between the privilege and oppression, how you see yourself and how society sees you as a man of color, as a white man, as a white woman, as a woman of color. And all of those things are colliding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I do think Igor makes such a good point that culture is making promises that the economy can't meet, right? That we're all of our images are of like the home that we live in, you know, when increasingly people are spending 60, 70, 80% of their income on rent, right? Mm-hmm. This, when I watch those movies, there's a disconnect, right, between what I'm told I should have and what I have access to. And I think that's part of it.
Yes.
And so you have the country changing, I mean, in terms of demographics, right? So we're looking at becoming a majority-minority nation as the demography changes in the country. We're seeing more interracial marriages. What is that doing in terms of just broadening or just changing the complexion of society, but also the relationships? The economy is also affecting folks, right? So there are people who found themselves in a precarious financial situation, maybe not this individual, but there are many who are finding themselves in that place. And then the view of masculinity and then privilege. I mean, I looked at the video and I'm like, wow, you know, seemed like a pretty good-looking kid. Seemed like he was, you know, had a nice car. Seemed like he had all the equipment. And I think oftentimes we, when we look at what one person has on the surface level, we don't get to the inside and see what's really happening there. The same way he may see that young African American or Mexican man who has, you know, who's with a white woman and says, "Hey, he has it all," right? But not realizing the struggle that he's also dealing with, or that other person is dealing with at some other point in life.
All these contradictions that come to fore with him as well that make that historically, go back to Igor here, that you know that white women as a whole have been the most protected class in America in many ways over the centuries in the society.
Well, I wouldn't say the most protected class.
Well, I think in some ways they have become that in terms of.
I'm just saying white men have had their stuff.
I'm protected in the larger sense.
It's more complicated than that. Anyway, go ahead.
But they also have been pushed as the most desired class in America, desires, and it came kind of crashing home in this, and all the contradictions kind of exploding. That's what I'm trying to say. Right. I'm saying exactly what you're saying, Kate. Exactly what you're saying. Igor?
Yes, and you look at how these guys, again, I go back to his online community, this anti-PUA community, they rate women on a scale of 1 to 10, 10, of course, being the most desirable. And I looked at what 10 means, what the 10 woman looks like. And, of course, she's white, she's blonde, she's, you know, voluptuous, everything you would think of as kind of the current ideal, that is a 10, and that is precisely the woman you're describing.
And, you know, and to your point and also to Mark's point, you know, it's funny you mentioned white women being the most protected. So if you think about the Ku Klux Klan, right, who were supposed to be the defenders of white womanhood, and many of the much of the violence, made the lynchings were predicated upon the, you know, fabricated or perceived slight against a white woman. At the same time, those same Klan members who were defending white womanhood were also mistreating the women in their lives and in their communities.
Right, exactly.
And so again, oftentimes the woman, particularly the white woman, has been used as a pawn in many instances as well, and then is just seen as an item or a totem to have.
Yeah, and being protected from one's own expression of sexuality or having choices or not being made an object. One doesn't necessarily want to be protected in that way.
Mark, here's something that we've not talked about. This young man was 22 years old, and at 22, he felt that he should have everything. Who has everything at 22? So you also, you know, our society allows us to look at people who have been working their whole lives, and what people see is the outcome of that effort, is the outcome of 20 and 30 years of working to get to a certain point. And then you have people who are 18, 19, 20 and saying, I should have that now. Not thinking, well, wait a minute, they worked for that. Nobody sees the journey. They see the end of the journey. And we've got to start having more conversations about the journey. And about the fact that at 22 years old, you're not going to have your whole life set in front of you. You're not going to have everything that a 40 or 50-year-old has. You're not going to have everything that, you know, somebody who is a rap superstar or basketball player or whatever has. That there are different realities, and your reality is your current reality, but here are the tools to make your reality something else if that's what you want. But this entitlement, we have to have it now culture is also what we're living in.
Yeah, and we're living in a youth-based culture, right? Think of how few cultural representations you have of people who are out of their 20s, right? And so at 20, that's, you know, in your 20s, that's when it's the time of your life and everything's amazing. You know, and as somebody who's almost 40 who, you know, is just now could afford a second bicycle, I'm a little – it's amazing that this guy in his BMW is feeling such a great loss.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if what you see on your campus, but I don't mean to demean any of my students, because most of my students are really great and we're just done the semester. But I do have a number of students who expect things, right, that mm-hmm. if they don't get an A, then it's something that you must have done, as opposed to, well, maybe I didn't do something else to get it. Mm-hmm. Or the expectation that as soon as I get out of college, it's going to be a fabulous job here, I'm going to have a car. It's like, I didn't have that when I graduated. I'm doing well now, but I didn't have that then. And so there's a struggle, and without struggle, there's no progress. But that oftentimes we want to give our kids everything, but we don't give them the knowledge of that struggle, regardless of race, class, or gender.
And our culture fuels those expectations.
Yes. Yeah, I run a salary negotiation workshop for students on my campus, and we one thing that we practice is it's called Start Smart. But one thing that we practice is budgeting. And I ask, how much do you expect to make at your first job out of mm-hmm. college? And they say things like $50,000, which is a salary I didn't make until I was 35, and, you know, with a PhD, and I felt incredibly rich when that moment occurred. And I asked them to do their expenses, and they always forget student loan payments, right, or insurance. And it's not because our students are just like I was when I was a student, which is I didn't know anything and I just signed up for all the credit cards because you got a free candy bar. So I think teaching a sort of a longer view, I think, is really important.
And it also raises the question of how you counteract the things we talk about that we say society's been permeated with, both in its historical sense, but also in terms of what has happened in the last 20 years to ramp up the constant bombardment of sexuality in people's lives and violence in people's lives, just because you see it so much. You know,
I think we have to teach media literacy, and we have to teach history, and we have to teach people how to make their own media, I think, are some things I try to do in my job as a gender studies professor.
Mm-hmm. Igor?
Yeah, and if your world that you're living in, your reality, isn't, you know, economically successful, personally successful, then you do pull from these cultural representations of everything being easy, everything being quick, happening to you by the time you're 22 or 25, those become your goals. That becomes your reality if what you have and what you're living with simply isn't enough.
And the history perspective, I think that that is so important. And I think that we need to take people outside of the context of how they are viewed mm-hmm. in America in this reality, and particularly for communities of color. Again, we didn't talk a lot about this, but that was such a load of internalized oppression, internalized self-hatred that this young man had. We need to teach people, especially our youth of color and white youth too, where they are in society, the real deal of it, both the privilege and the structural barriers along the way, and then teach better coping skills to help them in overcoming that and succeeding within this context.
Mm-hmm. And the only thing I'd add along with the coping skills is really having boundaries. I mean, social media can be a great thing, but a steady diet of anything can be truly harmful, whether we're talking about pornography, if we're just talking about self-promotion, what have you. And so you have so many people who get involved into that and they think this is going to make them a star, right? Reality mm-hmm. TV, all these kinds of things where people want to be seen. So teaching those boundaries, you can turn off the phone sometimes. You don't always have to put all your business out there, but also just to really set those boundaries, I think that's really important.
Well, and can I echo just real quick the importance of teaching the structural poverty, right? Because we have a tendency to blame people who don't have money for their own poverty. And that's not why people are poor. That's actually a product of history and the present and policy and structural constraints.
Amen.
You know, what's amazing here is that this man used social media to kind of share and vent his anger. He had his YouTube videos. He had the forums that he was participating in. This was very public, and he wanted to share it with the world, to interact with it, to put it out there so that he wasn't keeping it inside of him. And, you know, the fact that this was all so visible to anyone who dared look, to his own parents, who saw it far too late and nothing was done to prevent it, or at least he was able to kind of slip through the cracks of the law enforcement system, of the mental health system maybe, is also fairly remarkable, I think.
So I do want to thank you all. This has been a really fascinating discussion that you just heard Igor Volsky, before that to Dr. Kate Trubinsky. We're here also with Adara mm-hmm. Ayira is with us, Dr. John Bullock. Good to have all four of you with us.
Thank you.
It's been a great conversation.
Thank you.
We'll continue this. We're going to take a break now. You're going to hear a little bit of T-Bone Walker under us because it's his birthday and one of the great blues guys. But we're going to come right back with Beverly Burke. We have some breaking news, very tragic breaking news that we want to share with all of you in a moment. So please don't go away. Stay with us.